Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:13, that's Pacific Summer Time, and today is Friday, July 22nd. And of course, being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. But first, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. And perhaps right at the top of the list has got to be that the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones have been extending their breakouts, and they have been followed higher by the unifying characteristic for markets that have been breaking out to new highs is either that they have highly competitive yields or that they offer potential for outsized capital appreciation. So New Zealand has been outperforming for quite some time, and not least because of its AAA rating and the fact that it has got this reasonably wide interest rate differential. But of course, when you move a little bit further down the rating scale, then there are much higher yields to be found. So then Indonesia around 6% on just an overnight deposit, and Brazil closer to 14%, then much of Latin America. Obviously, Argentina is a very different kettle of fish, because it has an overnight interest rate of over 22%. That's despite the fact, of course, that they have a new administration that is reform-minded, and that they're allowing the currency to float freely, so that there isn't this arbitrage between the black market and the spot rate any longer. But obviously, Argentina has got a long way to go in terms of its reform agenda. The new government in Brazil is getting the benefit of the doubt. Colombia is outperforming, so is Chile. Chile hasn't got nearly the same high interest rates as some of those other countries, but certainly Colombia does. And of course, just recently you've had a peace treaty signed with the FARC guerrillas. Quite whether that is going to result in an end to the cocaine trade is quite a different proposition from the potential that it could lead to some form of peace in much of the country, and therefore allow growth to take off. Perhaps the more important factor is that with such high interest rate differentials, that there'll be money flowing into those countries that will allow that yield differential to contract by virtue of the fact that prices will rise, and then that's why they're outperforming. Then in Eastern Europe, you have the Baltic states are also really quite notable for their outperformance, and they obviously have been much smaller than some of the much more troubled European economies, but they largely sidestepped the real problems that affected the Eurozone, not least because they came into the Eurozone quite a bit after everybody else, and then they took some very hard decisions and then carried through on them. So they are now reaping the benefits, regardless of the fact that Russia is right on their doorstep and exhibiting much more adventurous or aggressive characteristics than it has done for quite some time. When we look at the precious metals sector, then there is the risk here that we have seen a peak of near-term significance, and that we are into a process of mean reversion. And of course, precious metals, and particularly gold and silver, had benefited quite considerably from heightened risk aversion, not least in the aftermath of the Brexit vote, and they had outperformed just about everything else. So had bonds and the yen. Well, with Wall Street breaking to new highs, the perception of the not so much a desire but a requirement to have some form of hedge has decreased, and therefore we are getting a little bit of backing and filling in the precious metals. And silver has been very steady and continues to consolidate around this $20 area, but it could be in this area and trade slightly lower, or potentially quite a bit lower, to get back to the region of the moving average, because it had run up so very swiftly prior to that. Platinum, having been very strong yesterday, was down over $20 in here today, so pretty much countermanding that upward dynamic and continuing to confirm resistance in the region of this 1100 area. And gold was down an additional $7 in here today, so this also looks like a reversionary process. But of course, silver and the gold shares represent a high beta play, on the gold price. So gold shares in particular are really quite overextended, and then the potential for a pause and consolidation is looking more likely than not. And that's really a very short-term consideration. When we look at the medium term, then gold prices look like they're on a recovery trajectory. They had been trending lower for the better part of 4 years, and now that downtrend is broken. When we look at the kind of issues that face the global economy, having some form of hedge against a rather deleterious outcome in some asset class would look to be prudent, and therefore these represent buys on pullbacks, and that would suggest that we are going to get a reasonably attractive buying opportunity in the precious metals in the not too distant future. Often what you will see, and we have ample example of this, is that when something becomes really very overextended relative to the trend mean, then it pauses, and that it might go sideways for a while, but as the bulls lose patience, then you can have a somewhat swifter pullback to the region of the moving average, and that really shakes out some of those weaker holders, and then you get a bounce. Well, we haven't had the swift part of the pullback in the precious metals, and we couldn't be overly surprised if we do get a short, sharp pullback, which presents a quick buying opportunity before we get a rebound. And that might not be the base case, but it's certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility either. And having been shaken out of my platinum earlier on this week, that's certainly what I'm hoping for. So hopefully that's not the triumph of hope over experience. Then when we look at the commodity sector generally, the relative strength of the dollar is taking a little bit of a toll, and it isn't just the CRB index, which is very heavily weighted towards oil, but it is the continuous commodity index has also pulled back a bit in here this week. That is obviously because oil prices have been pulling back, and Brent crude was as low today as 45.17 and closed closer to 45.75 at the end of the day. But it is now trading below its 200-day moving average. It has broken the short-term progression of higher reaction lows, and this is a larger reaction than we've seen at any time since January. So that short-term uptrend has lost consistency. That's a categorical fact. Those are chart facts. There's nothing subjective about that. What it does, though, suggest is that when you get a very large rebound after an accelerated decline, what do you normally get after that? It's generally speaking, a short-term oversold condition is replaced by a short-term overbought condition. Then we're right in the region of the moving average, and people start to ask the question, what's really changed? And of course, what has really changed in the oil markets is that marginal production has become considerably more economic, closer to the $50 area than it was at the closer to the $30 area, and then the potential for additional supply to come back into the market is looking increasingly likely. And so that's the fundamental argument. But the technical action, what we would expect is that you get some consolidation in the region of the MA, and then you move into a volatile ranging environment, which could be characterized as a first step above a type 2 bottom, which is the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And you so often get the right-hand extension following a type 2 bottom or indeed top. So then that is potentially what is in front of us with the oil market. And I don't know that that's really what people are pricing in. I've seen a lot of bullish reports about oil prices. And then you had Schlumberger and Halliburton coming out today and saying they think that the oil price has bottomed. Well, they're not exactly early, are they? Prices have already almost doubled off the low, and we're already moving into the consolidation phase of this rebound. So what it does suggest is that they're getting more interest from their customers in the kind of services that they provide, and that generally suggests that activity is building once again. So one of the things that we have talked about practically ad nauseum is that there is a revolution going on in the production of energy. And then what that means is that we are in a position where we have left a decade-long period of time where energy prices were very high, and we're moving into a much more volatile time in terms of energy pricing, but overall the prices will be on average lower. And that removes a considerable headwind in terms of the subpar economic growth that we've had. So there's a lot of commentary going on right now about where is the growth going to come from, and the deflationary impact that technological innovation has had on economic growth. And that is certainly true. What we've continued to see is that the velocity of money in the USA has been trending lower since 1997, and there is a very tight correlation there between the introduction of the internet and then the disintermediation that has created in the economy, and therefore the velocity of money has been deteriorating. But of course, for much of that environment, and particularly from about 2003, 4, and 5 on, we've had a high energy price environment, which has also acted as a headwind to economic growth. And what we really need is productivity growth to drive efficiency gains in the economy, and then to push on to better economic growth. And there are, I think, four main themes. Obviously, energy is one of them, because it isn't just about oil supply and demand. It's about the impact that technology is having on the demand cycle. And I think it was the Saudi Arabian oil minister said in as early as 2003 that it was the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones, and the oil age won't end because we run out of oil. And he was predicting peak demand, and we might indeed be pretty close to that with the evolution of electric cars and then increasing efficiency in the battery sector. And that has been slow to develop, but there are really quite promising technologies out there that haven't quite reached commercial utility just yet. But there is certainly a lot of money pouring into that sector. And what it means is that the higher prices go, the more supply will come into the market. And then all the way through, the more electric cars you have on the road, the less demand there is per capita for oil or for oil products. So not only does it remove a headwind to economic growth, but that it could quite potentially change the dynamics of the economy altogether, and could potentially lead then to the kind of efficiency gains and productivity growth that have so far been elusive in the way that, at least the way economists tend to measure those types of things. The second really big theme is the rise of the global consumer. And again, it is also influenced heavily by technology, because and governance. And governance really is, you really just trump just about everything else. Particularly when we look at emerging markets. When we have the global population expanding, it's absolutely essential that governance improves so that all of those additional people can get to reach their productive capacity. And the good news is that in major population centers like India, like Indonesia, mixed in China, but then also even in places like Nigeria, Brazil, we're seeing governance improving, albeit from a low base. And we have ample examples of where governance has failed, and what the failure of governance and the failure of administrations to deliver upon the expectations of their populations for better standards of living. And that's particularly the case in the Middle East, where we just had a failed coup in Turkey, where we have an ongoing war in Syria and in Yemen, and incredible dissatisfaction. And that dissatisfaction with both their people's lot in the world, and who exactly they blame, and what they're willing to do about it is being really being shown in any number of different ways, but perhaps most particularly in the failure of Europe to deal with integration of people, the just terrorism that we're continuing to see spikes of, and that is not just in Europe but in the USA as well, and then, you know, and of course outright war in a number of countries. So those are examples of where governance really can go wrong, and it's an object lesson for just about everywhere else how not to do things, that people really do need to have the belief that they have some control over their fates, and that if they work hard that they can have a better outcome. And that is also, of course, the case in developed economies, where you know, the people have certainly had some doubts about that potential outcome in Europe and in the USA. So what that is also, so the rise of the global middle class is heavily influenced by improving governance. And certainly it is the large population countries are leading in that regard right now, and they're being boosted by the fact that the availability of technology is now pretty much ubiquitous. So as soon as something is developed, it goes global almost instantly, and therefore new consumers get access to really cutting edge pieces of technology from the get-go, and it allows them to progress at increasingly rapid rates, in fact rates that are quite a bit more rapid than have been possible previously. So then that would be the second one, and of course the third one is healthcare and technology more generally, because the pace of technological innovation is developing so rapidly, and particularly in the healthcare sector, because with the development of CRISPR, where you have the cost and speed of genetic editing has been reduced by multiples. The cost of genetic profiling has gone from hundreds of thousands of dollars a decade ago to less than $1,000 today. And despite the fact that the biotechnology sector, which was the darling of the stock market at this time last year, has experienced really quite a considerable pullback, well, now we have evidence that of base formation development, and in fact the Nasdaq Biotech Index is right now in the region of the 200-day moving average, and a sustained move above it would begin to suggest that demand is back in the driver's seat beyond the short term, and particularly we could be into a recovery situation. So that also helps to confirm that. And when you look at the fundamentals of these companies, it's not like they don't have earnings. Many of them have highly profitable, viable products in the market. This is not like we had in the 1990s, where these were companies that were trading on ideas, whereas today they're trading on products. And we have those. We have evidence that, you know, valuations are not nearly as ambitious now as they would have been a year ago. And the potential for enhancements in medical care really does have a transformative effect on economics. And particularly, for example, with the efforts that are currently underway to alleviate malaria. And there are pretty scary statistics out there that malaria has killed more people in human history than any other factor. And when you think about the countries that are plagued by malaria and their subpar economic growth, well, it's not difficult to understand why families have to have larger numbers of children to compensate for the higher mortality rate, and then the impact that it has on people, where it slows them down. So it doesn't kill you outright, but it's a very long, slow process, which means that, you know, larger numbers of the family have to take care of people, and that takes them out of the labor force as well. You solve malaria, then potentially you have you could create growth centers just by alleviating that one thing. But what we have is the potential to alleviate a number of diseases and to take out of take the problem out of growing old, where people live longer but they live healthier lives, and that means they can work for longer, the productivity is enhanced for longer, and that also helps to solve some of the debt problems. And the debt is a problem, and that really is the fourth theme, because when we look around, there is just about every developed central bank is printing money, and we're in a situation where that is unlikely to change. And it was interesting this week that the Japanese yen posted an upside key reversal yesterday, and the Nikkei was down 1% today. And Japan is still to-ing and fro-ing about just how much quantitative easing it needs, but the market is really quite clear that without quantitative easing, that this market is not going higher. And I saw a very interesting article today as well, talking about the euro and saying that, well, the ECB hasn't been engaged in quantitative easing for a year and the euro hasn't gone anywhere. But of course, what we know from the chart seminar is that a range is an explosion waiting to happen. So the longer the range persists, the greater the likelihood is that when it does break out, it is going to do so in a dynamic fashion and take and move faster and farther than anyone has been used to in the context of the range. And right now the euro is trading back down towards the lower side of its range, and it's currently trading below 110 to the dollar. And the ECB needs additional quantitative easing. And they are running up against self-imposed limits on how many bonds they can buy. And of course, the easy answer to that particular question is to remove the limits. In which case, the potential for German bonds in particular to move further into negative territory will become even more compelling. And the ability of the ECB to continue to print will improve even further. But then the Fed is largely unable to raise interest rates because everyone else is cutting, and the upward pressure that would put on the dollar is perhaps not something that would be particularly conducive to achieving their particular goals. So they're going to be very, very cautious indeed. And that is pretty much par for the course, because central banks are very cautious. They very seldom move in advance of clear evidence that they have to. And that generally contributes to the conclusion that they are serial bubble blowers, and that we are potentially now moving into that kind of phase. It has been a big question whether we were going to get a big pullback when interest rates were normalized, and then the bull market would progress following what had been the normalization of interest rates. Things could really start to get going. And the alternative is that the interest rate environment remains in this extraordinarily low phase for much longer than anyone had anticipated, and that valuations in assets that cannot simply be printed into existence become truly overvalued, and that the eventual normalization of interest rates is the factor that pops an evolving bubble. And then it's a very easy question to answer. And is there any evidence that monetary policy is being normalized right now? And one would have to conclude not a great deal. And that's particularly the case in Europe and Japan and China and a host of other countries. And the Fed has raised interest rates once and still has just about all the money on its balance sheet. And then how likely is it that they're going to be able to raise rates again this year? The S&P 500 has now broken up out of an 18-month range, and it continues to progress, and I think it's been only down 2 days in a row, and even those were not dynamic moves. So there is a temptation to look at this and say it's overbought, and even a temptation to say, well, it's overbought, so it should short this market. But there was no evidence yet that this is over, and that breakouts can progress for longer and go further than we have been conditioned by the range to expect. So I'm going to I'm not going to give in to that temptation, but rather continue to think that this breakout is going to continue, and that any consolidation we have is likely to be above the range. And that would suggest that in the absence of any potential for normalization of monetary policy, that these breakouts are going to persist. That we could potentially move into an environment where the extraordinary monetary policy that has helped propel what has been a liquidity-fueled rally persists indefinitely, at least to the extent that the market can price in indefinitely, which is usually about 18 months or 2 years, and that that we move into what could potentially be the third psychological perception stage of a bull market, which would be the acceleration or the euphoria stage. Well, it's the euphoria stage, which could potentially then end in an acceleration. And then we get a crash when nominal interest rates begin to rise. And so far, there isn't any reason to really question that. What we do have the potential for is that, and I think David characterized it as Wall Street as the best house on a bad street, but perhaps we might look at the dollar and say that the dollar is the best house on a bad street, because the Europeans, considering the problems that they face, the issues that they have with having created a currency without harmonized fiscal and, I think, social security union, or at least federal transfers, then that is a contradiction that is perhaps now unwinding. And I don't think it's a question of whether the euro will still be around, because the euro is the Deutschmark. The euro will only persist for as long as it is in the interests of Germany. And that would suggest then that the euro will go down before it goes up, and the only reason that it would go up is because some of the weaker members are forced out. But that would create an existential crisis for Europe. And that is why we have been of the view for quite some time that the UK deciding to leave the eurozone is much more of a problem for Europe than it is for the UK. So that is a potential issue. That is something that represents a threat to the not just Europe, but to the global stock market. But then the question is how long and when is that eventual denouement likely to occur? Now, it is perhaps another big question for Europe. Having forced depositors into a bail-in in Cyprus, the Europeans introduced rules that any other bank bailouts would force the wiping out of depositors before a bank could be recapitalized. And we're going to get an idea of just how serious the Europeans are about this in Italy. One would have to also look at some of those German banks like Deutsche or Commerzbank, which really do look like they're in trouble, and not least because they have significant holdings outside of Germany and all over Europe. Well, if they do force Italy to wipe out depositors, then the government will fall, and it is very questionable whether Italy can actually survive within the euro, not just from a monetary perspective, but from a political perspective. And the countermanding argument to that is that the Europeans have got a long history of having one rule for big countries and another for small countries, and whether they really do have the stomach to impose that kind of issue on one of the founding members of the EU. So and that represents a very large uncertainty. So that is perhaps the biggest risk that we have out there right now. But in the meantime, Wall Street continues to push higher. this issue with Italy is probably at least a few months away, and it might not be an issue at all if they don't impose that kind of stringency on an in trouble country, but rather just give them the money that they need, which would be the most expedient way of doing it. Then that also helps to feed through into why gold and the precious metals are a buy on pullbacks, and then the bond markets in that environment are likely to remain with yields that are really very low. Now, we're not going to have a big spike in yields and a break of that medium-term downtrend until we get normalization of interest rates, and that could be still quite a way away. And not least because we've had some flattening of the yield curve, but it's still a fair way away from an inverted condition, which would be a lead indicator of about 18 months, a lead indicator for a recession. And that would suggest that we have a window of opportunity where prices could go up before they have to come down. And then it would be worth giving the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.